If you're enjoying these episodes of Yankton's Yardbirds, join us on our support site called buymeacoffee.com. Please consider clicking the Support the Show link included in the description of each show. You can choose to donate $5, $10, $15, or $20, or you can become a member. Members will receive extra content that will be added as the shows progress. This will include pictures of the vets, audio interviews, maps, write-ups, and much more content that will be available to members only. Please consider making a donation or becoming a member soon. And as always, thank you for listening to Yankton's Yardbirds. Today's podcast is sponsored by David M. Hosmer Law Office, which is celebrating David's 30th year practicing law. You may not need a lawyer, but when you do, you need an excellent one. Contact him at davidhosmer@hotmail.com.
Welcome to Yankton's Yardbirds, a podcast presenting the World War II stories of Yankton's veterans. After 165 interviews and countless hours of preparation, it's time to share these stories. As of now, they'll be shared by podcast and later will be presented in print. If you have questions, free to contact me at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. Please be advised that there is some offensive language within these interviews. When I'm speaking, I've edited my language to more modern times. Java remained in Allied hands, but the Japanese moved quickly. Spotters identified a Japanese convoy headed in that direction. On 26 February, an Allied strike force consisting of 15 ships, including the Houston, attempted to stop the Japanese from landing their troops. Beginning on the 27th, the two navies fought each other with their big guns and torpedoes for 2 days in the Battle of the Java Sea. There were no carriers involved, but the battle was a naval nail-biter. The Americans had no air cover while the Japanese did. There were fewer than 100 operable planes in Australia, and no American carriers participated in the battle. The flat tops shored up the delivery of men and supplies in the long supply chain from Hawaii to Australia. And they were also conducting raids, places like the Gilberts and Marshalls. Robert Hanley, who was aboard the Houston, was just a 19-year-old kid. Hailing from St. Paul, Minnesota, his parents were Leon and Frances Moulton Hanley. Robert was the oldest of the five children, and he graduated from Monroe High School in 1940. His father, a union man often forced to travel great distances just to keep his job, was a boilermaker for the Great Northern Railway. After high school graduation, Robert worked for the railroad too, but that was enough to convince him that he did not want to follow his father's footsteps in that manner. His father had been a Navy man during the Great War, although he rarely talked about it, but Robert emulated him in that fashion, and he enlisted on the 5th of January, 1941. He was just 18 years old, having been born on the 6th of February, 1922. After a stint aboard the USS Benham, he was transferred to the Philippines, where he was reassigned to the heavy cruiser Houston. Heavy cruisers have guns which exceed 6 inches, while battleships, which are heavier, had cannons larger than 8 inches. Those shells could travel 20 miles, explained Hanley. He was a seaman until he made a striker in the medical detail, which meant that he wanted to work a job for which he had not received formal training. His work was very basic, such as bandaging and giving shots. On the 27th of February, 14 Allied ships steamed northerly to screen the northern Java coast. The 18 Japanese ships had more firepower and substantial air cover. Because the Houston had been bombarded earlier that month, only 6 of her 8-inch guns were ready for action. The Allies tried several times to break through the Japanese front to attack the troop ships. After nearly 8 hours of fighting, only 2 of the Allied ships remained, one of which was the Houston. According to Hanley, all we had left were star shells, and you can't do anything with star shells. She had been struck by 2 Japanese 8-inch shells, but there was no additional damage. Her fight and escape to Batavia gave rise to her nickname, the Galloping Ghost of the Java Coast. It seemed like she was everywhere. By that time, even Tokyo Rose had reported that the Houston had been sunk several times. The Allied command wanted to keep up the fight but needed to unite its ships. The Houston refueled oil at Batavia before being ordered along with the Perth and Evertsen to travel from their northern Java port around the western end of Java through the Sunda Strait and to dock in a southern Java port. Hanley suggested that Australia was their ultimate destination because they also needed to restock their ammunition. Unbeknownst to them, the Japanese were at that moment in the process of landing troops on West Java. Under the close watch of 11 Japanese ships, 50 transport ships motorized to shore in the Banton Bay. The Houston with the Perth behind her spotted the transport shortly before midnight and fired on him. A Japanese cruiser spotted and sailed behind them and fired her torpedoes at him. They missed and struck their own Japanese transports. Both ships would have steered left and turned into the Sunda Strait, but after seeing Japanese ships on their port and starboard, they sailed straight ahead to the northwest. Both ran parallel to two Japanese cruisers. Hanley said there was a lot of firing going on in all directions, but the Japanese cruisers eventually fired their torpedoes and sank the Perth at around midnight. The Houston kept going until she took one torpedo in her side. "I could feel it when it hit," said Robert. Then three more hit her and she stopped. Japanese destroyers attacked her with machine gun fire while she rolled over and sank at about 12:45 a.m. 1st of March. The Evertsen, a few hours behind, tried to run, but she too was struck, and the captain intentionally breached her on a coral reef on the Cebuco Island. Hanley has a clear memory of that night. The ship started to take on water, and the men were told to abandon ship. Many men didn't heed that order, including some Marines who swore they would go down with the ship, and then a second order to abandon ship was issued. In the midst of this chaos, Robert searched and searched for a life jacket. Men jumped off the ship, and he intended to follow them. He gave up his search and began to strip off his clothing. His mind ran back to his younger days swimming en natural in Pickerel Lake adjacent to the Mississippi River. This is where he learned to swim. There were no swimming lessons. He was now operating on instinct and a desire to survive. Wearing only his skivvies, he dove off the fantail into the warm waters of the Java Sea. After leaping into the dark waters, he swam away from the Houston, which was turning over. As he peered across the water, his vision was limited. There were very few lights other than the moon overhead. It made sense to swim toward land, but this required him to swim through Japanese ships and troop transports. Some men did. He eventually heard noises and swam in toward that direction. He came upon a raft from the Houston. Men held onto the sides of the raft as they looked after a seriously injured man laying atop the raft. This went on for many hours. The sun was just about to rise, and he saw a small boat approach him. As it neared, he could see that it was a Japanese craft. A Japanese soldier aimed a machine gun directly at him. His mind raced, and he wondered if this was the end. However, he and the other men in his raft were pulled aboard and stowed in the hold. 368 of the 1,068 men aboard the Houston survived the sinking. However, they were about to experience even more hell. After the failed attempt by ABDA to stop the Japanese in the Java Sea, it was up to the 34,000 men on Java to fend off the Japanese invasion. Nearly 25,000 of the men were poorly trained, however. There was only one American unit, the 2nd Battalion of the 131st Field Artillery, and it was attached to the Australian Black Force, so named after the general in his charge. The 131st, which was originally attached to the 36th Division, another Texas National Guard unit, had been on its way to the Philippines, just like the 147th, when Pearl Harbor was attacked. Their ship was diverted to Java, arriving on 11 January 1942. The Japanese continued to land their troops on the west end of Java that morning of the 1st of March, despite the fireworks during the prior early morning hours. The Australians and the 131st fought for 2 days, but on the 8th, all Allied forces on Java surrendered. Roy E. Stensland, a South Dakota boy from the lucky 147th, had joined Robinson on his trip to Java. At the last moment, Roy was sent to the 131st while Robinson escaped to Australia. Roy was captured at the Battle of Java. It was at that moment that the Japanese controlled all the Dutch East Indies. The Houston survivors were put ashore west of Batavia. After a day of waiting and hauling supplies, they were taken to Serang and housed within a densely crowded theater. Hanley said this was one of his worst moments because he developed bacillary dysentery. "I almost died," he said. "I was bleeding from my bowels." When it was time to leave in April, Robert was still helpless. He couldn't move. If it weren't for the help of Alvin Kapp, who lifted him up and placed him in the truck, he would not have made it. "He saved my life," said Robert. The next 7 months of captivity for the 131st Battalion and the Houston survivors were spent in Java at an area known as the Bicycle Camp. Located in Senen, a part of Welteren, its prior usage had been a barracks for the 10th Battalion Bicycle Unit in the Netherlands East Indies Army. Joining them were men from the 2nd Battalion, 131st Field Artillery, known as the Lost Battalion, because their whereabouts were unknown for many years. This would be the most humane conditions for Robert while in Japanese custody. There was running water, showers, and some food. A doctor amongst the prisoners, Commander Epstein, heard that Robert worked in the infirmary, so he was tasked with helping him with bandages and medications. "This led to me working in surgery with another third-class petty officer," said Hanley. He sterilized instruments and assisted, and later conducted small surgery by himself. In October, Hanley and another 120 prisoners were told they were leaving. A doctor threw a bag at me and said, "You're it." I was to take care of 120 men. They were jammed into the putrid hold of a Japanese freighter where they spent several days worried about their safety. There was little food and much sickness. They arrived at Changi Camp in Singapore, where they stayed a few months, and then some even further, to Mulmin, Burma.
If you are interested in sponsoring an episode of Yankton's Yardbirds, please contact David Hosmer at davidhosmer@hotmail.com. All content for this podcast was created by David Hosmer, and all production was performed by Eric Berenger. Thank you for listening to this episode of Yankton's Yardbirds.